Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Formula One Grid Talk. This is episode 194. My name is Tom Horrocks, and today on F1 Firesides, we have another fascinating conversation for you. Have you ever wondered how deals are done with sponsors? Well, Jeremy Scoones has the answer for you, as he is the founder and CEO of Front Row Marketing. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing? Great to be here.
Yeah, really good. Really enjoying the lack of sun. It's now gone away and it's lovely and raining here.
It's miserable outside.
That's our summer definitely gone. But if you're enjoying these episodes, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify, as this really helps us climb up the rankings. And we might even give you a shout out, as I think you're on the next show too. As well as these fireside chats, we do previews, reviews, and analysis of every race weekend on YouTube and on all major audio platforms too. Just search for F1 Chronicle or F1Chronicle.com to find out more. Make sure you subscribe and click the bell on YouTube to know when we are live. So in a nutshell then, Jeremy, can you explain to our listeners and to me as well what it is that Front Row Marketing actually does in the sport of F1 and just sport in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, if you like, a middleman. We're a sort of an introducer. So you've obviously got lots of teams that are involved in the hunt for partners. And we are out there in the marketplace talking to brands and understanding about what they might be looking for, and then hopefully helping introduce them to the right teams to get a deal done. So we're very much sort of the middleman in a lot of these deals, teams will use various tools to recruit partners, and introducers are an important part of that. So that's what we do.
Cool. Okay. So how many people are there kind of fighting over this position? Are you one of the big fish, or are you kind of fairly new to the game?
I'm definitely a minnow. I mean, you can imagine it's tremendously competitive.
Yes.
Formula One, because of its popularity, because it's the pinnacle, it attracts by far the largest amount of investment in motorsport globally. And therefore, there's an awful lot of people like me out there. Some of them are big agencies like CSM and Prism and other big agencies that are part of big groups. And then you have people like me, which are much, much smaller. But, you know, we've been around a while and we've got to know quite a few people. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to contacts and connections. And if you can use those and get through to the right people, then there's definitely deals to be done. And obviously, we don't charge the sort of the big heady fees that some of these big agencies do. So that's our advantage, at least. But it's very competitive. The race for commercial sponsorship is as intense as the on-track activity. It's just that you don't really see it, but it's just as cutthroat. It's just as competitive, and it's very, very, very intense.
I can imagine. So I imagine then you haven't got a massive cut of that £150 million Oracle sponsorship deal then. I'm assuming you didn't preside over that one then, though.
Yeah, you know, those things don't come around that often. And we've seen a couple of big deals in Formula One recently. Obviously, the Bybit deal with Red Bull, which is a cybersecurity platform. The Oracle deal with Red Bull, you know, Red Bull doing very well commercially. We saw Cognizant on the Aston Martin, some sort of the return of some really seriously big deals. And if you are fortunate enough to put that together and be on a decent commission, then it's a tremendously exciting place to be. But it's definitely a real buzz, you know, when you find a brand that wants to get involved and you help to broker that deal and put the two parties together and make it work. It's very exciting.
So I'm assuming, obviously, you're a fan of Formula One. I can tell that from the memorabilia behind you, which I'm very jealous of. But has this always been your dream to do this role, or did you just kind of like a lot of people just fall into it unexpectedly?
Well, I've been Formula One obsessed since I was about 8 years old, and I was taken. My first memory of Formula One, I think, I was probably 19, 88. I sat at Beckett's, the old Beckett's as it was back then, in a soaking wet race with Ayrton Senna basically just doing what he did the best, which was just going outrageously quickly in wet weather. It was soaking wet. It was miserable day. We all got stuck in the car park for hours afterwards, as we used to do at Silverstone. But from then on, I was absolutely hooked. Followed the sport very closely. Didn't do anything at uni remotely related to what I do now. I did geography at university. And then I left uni and I thought, I'm desperate to get involved in motorsport. What could I do? And it was at a time when, sponsorship was really on the up. And I thought, well, maybe try and get involved in the marketing side. So that's what happened.
Wow, fantastic. So it wasn't just like sitting there on that cold morning in Silverstone thinking, I want to find out how those stickers get on the car.
No. It was an obsession with the sport. And then it was kind of, I want to be in that. I need to be involved in that somehow. And I wasn't an engineer, obviously. Mm. But I was quite good with people. And I thought maybe there's something I can do. I sent my CV off to all the teams and got rejected by all of them. But it was actually a Dr. Jonathan Palmer, who obviously was a former F1 driver and since then a very successful businessman. He had not long started quite a pioneering championship in the UK called Formula Palmer Audi, which was one of the first single make series, which really kind of put the skills of the driver at the heart rather than a driver's budget or the ability of the team. And I went and met him and he said, look, I don't have a job for you, but you can start tomorrow. So I turned up for work the next day and within a couple of months, because the series had been doing quite badly financially, so he had to change it from a young driver's championship to a more of a kind of a gentleman's championship. And so he let a lot of staff go, unfortunately, and I suddenly found myself, I was doing the marketing, the driver sales, I was writing the series magazine, I was doing all the accounts. And after about a year and a half, I look back now actually, and I was pretty close to a nervous breakdown actually. It was way too much. I was completely out of my depth. Jonathan is a very hard taskmaster, but it was the most amazing learning experience. And I got to see all angles of how motorsport business works and functions. And he knows what a good job looks like. It was very professionally run. And I decided after that, having seen a bit of everything, that I wanted to be involved in the sponsorship side. That was the bit that really sort of grabbed my attention. And this time when I wrote off to a few Formula One teams, I got a job in Toyota, who obviously came into Formula One in 2002, they entered. So I found myself sort of early 20s, living in Germany, being paid to go to most of the Formula One races, which was terrible. You know, you can imagine.
It sounds like you had a real, real put through the ringer there.
Yeah, it was awful. I mean, I look back now and I didn't realize at the time quite what a spoilt position it was working for Toyota. I mean, that team had money, you know, to burn. I remember flying from Cologne to Paul Ricard. They used to charter a private plane for the team. And I remember flying over Paul Ricard, looking down. It was a three-car test. So we had, you know, three cars out on the track at one time and then landing on the runway in the middle of Paul Ricard on a private plane. I mean, at the time, I just thought all this was absolutely normal. And of course it isn't. And, since then it's been, I've looked back at that with quite rose-tinted spectacles. But so a couple of years, a few years with Toyota looking after sponsors. And then sort of subsequently worked for a few other teams as well. So it's been amazing, and I'm very lucky, very privileged to have had the opportunity.
So when did the seed get sown to actually start your own company up?
Well, I'd always been thinking about it for a long time, but never really had the guts. I mean, it's a big leap to do that. So I'd never really had the courage. I was very heavily involved in F1 until about 2011, and then I worked for Aston Martin for 10 years, mainly on their sports car racing project, the GT program. At Le Mans and things. And when that kind of came to an end in 2020, obviously Lawrence Stroll had bought Aston Martin. So the sports car racing program finished. And it was then that I thought, okay, well, yeah, unless we do this now, we're never, ever going to do it. So, August 2020, we went for it. And I'm really pleased. And I was in a good place at the right time to start working with the Aston F1 team. And we quite quickly put together the NetApp deal, which is on the Aston at the moment. Mm-hmm. And we were involved in the early stages of the Pironi deal, which is on the Aston as well. So really, exciting times. And since then, it's just been crazy, really. but it's good fun. I mean, Formula One is in a great place right now.
Yeah, it's great to see that so many big names are wanting to get involved in Formula One now and line up with the teams, and the role that you play in that absolutely crucial. So I mean, did you ever dream about racing yourself, or is that always just not on your radar?
I still do. I'm still convinced I'm going to be a Formula One driver one day. I'm never going to give that up. The fact that I'm 6'6" and really untalented, doesn't really come into it. Of course, you know, I'm a frustrated racing driver, probably like half the people that work in motorsport. You need incredible skill, commitment, a decent amount of cash to get going, and a lot of luck. You need to be a winner. So unfortunately, I didn't quite have a few of those assets. But yeah, I mean, what about you? You must have wanted to do that as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I am now starting to realize at the age of 40 that perhaps that I might not be getting that call from McLaren to go. But you know, Ricciardo's having a bad season, so you never know. There's still hope. I might yet get the phone call this year. That's the hope. But no, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's like wanting to be a professional footballer. It's just one in a 10 million people or something have an outside chance of it. So,
but it's even worse in motorsport, because at least with football, you've kind of got a lot of different teams in various countries. I mean, I don't know what the average professional footballer makes, but it feels like there's more of an opportunity to make a living playing football. Whereas with motorsport, you can be an absolute megastar and be winning in Formula 2 and other categories, but you're having to pay for your seat. Mm. That's a tough hill to climb. You know, to make a living out of it, you've got to be very exceptional. So obviously in Formula 1, you've got the pinnacle, but there are some absolutely incredible drivers in sports car racing and other forms of motorsport that you may not hear about, but they're making a living because they are, they're absolutely fantastic. They might not have had the brakes to make it into Formula 1, but they are incredibly talented. And that was one thing actually that I learned. Where, when you're working in Formula 1, you tend to feel like there's no world beyond Formula One, and everything outside Formula One is just rubbish. Mm-hmm. And then when I got involved in sports car racing, you realize actually that's not the case. There are some seriously talented drivers in all categories of motorsport. But for whatever reason, whether it's politics or money or whatever, perhaps they don't quite get that chance. But it's incredible the talent that is out there, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that obviously you work in sports car series as well. What's the difference in? I mean, obviously it's probably night and day, but the difference with Formula One and sports car, what, like for your role, how does that differ?
Yeah, quite simply, the biggest thing is eyeballs. Formula One, the world watches it. You've got an absolutely amazing global audience. I think in terms of cumulative audience over a year, it's like 1.5 billion, and you've got a sort of unique fans. You've got about 450 million worldwide. sports car racing, the audience is just a lot smaller. It's also more difficult to understand. You can probably walk into any boardroom and talk about Formula One and people will know what you mean. Ah, Lewis Hamilton, or oh, Michael Schumacher, if they're a bit older. Sports car racing, you've got to do a bit of explaining first. And that makes it obviously a harder sell. So the money that Formula One commands is a lot greater. And that's because the attention is a lot greater. So whereas your discussion around Formula One will be a lot more about brand awareness, global exposure, your discussion around sports car racing, there'll be a little bit of that, but it'll be more around, much more emphasis on sort of storytelling. And there might be, because there are manufacturers involved in sports car racing as well, there might be sort of a big business to business angle with the manufacturer as well. So yeah, it's a different proposition and it's a harder sell. Yeah.
But the product itself is still a very strong product as well. I'm not a huge follower of sports car racing, but when I do watch it, I do think I am kind of amazed at just how much goes into that as well.
Yes.
For pound for pound, it's just as competitive and just as good a product. But back into Formula One, you've obviously been involved in Formula One for 20 years. You've been around Formula One now.
Yeah. So 10 years very intensively, and then sort of back into it since starting my own business over the last couple of years. So, but always quite close to it. Yeah.
So how close do you get with some of those big names in Formula One? You've got your Bernies, your Flavios, and all that kind of people. Do you ever get involved in with them at all, or are they kind of do they have people, they have people doing those jobs for them?
Yeah, no, I've had a real opportunity to work very closely with some of the big names, and there are some fantastic characters in the sport. Obviously, I was lucky enough to work at McLaren for a little while, and didn't have a huge amount to do with Ron Dennis, but his reputation for being a hard taskmaster is definitely right. I remember sitting outside the motorhome with him and one of the senior executives from ExxonMobil, who were a big McLaren partner at the time, and my job was to look after the ExxonMobil. And this very senior guy from ExxonMobil was very kind and said to Ron, Jeremy's doing an excellent job for us. We're really happy. And in front of this guy, Ron just turned to me and just went, "We'll see about that." So, I was like, okay. And then a little bit later on, I had a chance to work a fair bit. I was actually on the sponsor side when ING was sponsoring Renault. I had an opportunity to work a little bit with Flavio. What a character. he used to call me Mr. Bean. So that was my he didn't even bother calling me Mr. Bean, actually. He just called me Bean. It would be kind of, "Hey, Bean." He was a very interesting character. We when the ING deal was announced, we were summoned to his office, which is it was just off in Kensington in London, and we were led up these stairs to this kind of very bizarre, all I can describe it as, that there was just black leather everywhere on the walls, on the couch. It was real kind of I don't know what to describe it. Let's just say it didn't feel like an office. It felt like something else. And bearing it, ING were paying a huge amount of money. I think it was something like, 40 million euros a year sponsorship. And so we were summoned, the global head of marketing, you had some really senior people there. And this was supposed to be the kickoff meeting where we would be introduced to him and we would hopefully all have a nice introduction and everything would be nice. Anyway, he comes in, he came in late and then proceeded basically to give us an absolute rollicking for 20 minutes, saying how, right, I don't want you talking to the media, I don't want you saying anything about team performance. And basically the message was, I know you're the sponsor, but you stay out of our way and we'll stay out of your way and we'll all be very happy together. And it was quite funny. It was proper, as you would expect from him, you know, real kind of the godfather at the top of the table, sort of just like, this is how it's going to be. And this is how it works. So, yeah, I mean, just really big characters. But what I would say about both of them is that Flavio and Ron Dennis are very different characters, but
yeah, incredible. Chalk and cheese.
Yeah, chalk and cheese, but both of them incredible salespeople. I mean, really, when you put them in front of a big company, their ability to tell the story and the confidence that they exude is really compelling. And you can understand why they're the boss of these teams and people are ready to follow them into battle. You know, when you see people like that kind of operating in their window, it's very, very impressive. So you kind of have, there's plenty of times when you sort of just sit there in awe of, you know, how these guys at the top are thinking and how they're operating and how they're articulating things. It's very, very cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, Flavio is definitely a polarizing character, and I'm pretty sure he could sell ice to Eskimos. He's just one of those people that you just
absolutely,
he just has a way with words, and just seems to be able to broker any kind of deal. But you worked with Virgin as well for a bit, didn't you? Or your company did, at least? Or
yes, no, I was an account manager for Virgin Racing. So obviously it was a relatively short-lived sort of partnership under the Virgin banner. Mm. I was very lucky enough to work with John Booth, who of Manor Motorsport fame, who was just fantastic, sort of down to earth, just proper racer. The only team principal I've ever actually seen get under a Formula One car and start spannering it, you know, really just on it. And then on the other side of the scale, in that partnership, you had Richard Branson, very different character. Kind of slightly sort of set away from it, you know, quite a few steps away from it, but would come to the races and things. I mean, you just never really had the feeling that Virgin were kind of properly kind of into it, or that they really understood what exactly they'd kind of got. So, you know, unfortunately, it didn't last too long, that, and there was all that budget cap stuff as well, you know, the nonsense. I think it was Virgin, HRT and Caterham, wasn't it, that came in thinking that there was going to be a budget cap, only to find out that there wasn't, and actually it was going to be very tough. So difficult times, but still an interesting experience to see and to occasionally work with someone like Richard.
Probably about 10 years early they came into the sport, really. If they'd have come in now, they might have had the chance of surviving.
Absolutely. I was thinking that the other day. I mean, now would be the time for that and to do something like that. But I think probably their fingers have been well and truly burnt, and they're into Formula E, which kind of fits with their philosophy now. So
absolutely. So do you get involved with the teams in that sense, like with when they come to like trying to enter Formula One or get involved in Formula One in that way? Do you ever have any dealings with the teams in that sense with Formula One? Or is that kind of a bit beyond your remit?
Yeah, that's a little bit beyond my remit, really. I mean, I'm very much in the camp where once that's all been concluded and the team is ready and they're kind of ready to go, then it's kind of like, right, how do we fund this and how do we actually make this work commercially? That's when people like me tend to get involved. So that sort of thing would usually be down to the investors and or the CEO of the team, basically, or the team principal. Occasionally, I've been sort of fly on the wall to some of those conversations. I was a lot more involved in that, actually, at Aston Martin on the sports car racing side. But in Formula One, that tends to be the investors and the TV. So,
you're just awaiting the phone call from Michael Andretti then.
Yeah, that would be awesome, wouldn't it? Yeah, I mean, wow. What a fantastic thing that would be for Formula One to see that name back. I mean, I really hope that they do it. And they've got a very they've got a very strong commercial operation already. So if they decide to flick the switch on Formula One, they've got a very strong team already that they can switch over to start working on F1 quite quickly, which I think just makes them even more credible, actually, because quite a lot of these we've seen it so many times over the years. Rich guy buys Formula One team, loses lots of money because he can't fund it, and then just gets annoyed with it and sells it. But an organization like Andretti, it's a proper operation. They've got a commercial department. They know how things work. They could fund it. They could get sponsors, and it will be a proper team. Yeah. So that would be great for the sport.
I completely agree. It just seems like the teams don't seem to, and the FIA don't seem to want to allow it to happen, which for me, I just don't understand. You know, it's a legacy of one of the greatest Formula One drivers of all time in Mario, and certainly up there as in there, obviously ex-world champion Michael, not doing particularly well in Formula One, obviously, but so, just the name Andretti is just synonymous with all motorsport. You know, they're in Extreme E, they're in Formula E, IndyCar. Everywhere you look, you see Andretti, apart from Formula One. Why would Formula One not want Andretti in the sport? And I just think that the teams are just kind of, they just don't seem to want it. And I just don't understand why. Because for me, Formula One is a 24-car grid. It's been four cars short for a long time. And, you know, with Andretti and then with Audi coming in as well, and then potentially Porsche buying into another team, I think it's the perfect scenario to get us back up to that 24 teams.
I agree with you. I'm not really in a position to answer to the politics of that or why the teams might not want it. But from a commercial perspective, if I was working for a team, I'd probably be sat there quite worried about Andretti coming in. If you look at the global business structure, you know, the US is such an important market. There are so many high-tech companies coming out of the US that are ripe targets for sponsorship targeting for Formula One. I mean, the US is, especially the West Coast. To have someone like Mario Andretti suddenly going into the boardrooms in the US and asking for sponsorship for his team, if I was working for another F1 team, I'd probably I wouldn't find that too exciting either. It's definitely, it goes back to what I said, right? I mean, it's the competition, and there's a finite number of companies that are willing to spend. If you look at the sports industry as a whole, there is a massive over inventory of things to sponsor, and there aren't enough sponsors to go around. So the last thing the F1 teams need is someone like Mario Andretti walking into the boardrooms of America and hoovering up all the cash. But that's just from a very small sort of microcosm. There's obviously a bigger picture there as well, which I'm not sure about.
certainly does make sense. Yeah, but I mean, are you of the opinion now that Formula One has conquered America? Because obviously we just had the Miami Grand Prix, and how do you think that went? And just sort of Formula One in general in America now, is it there? Have we finally cracked it?
Well, put it this way, it's a lot better than it was last time I went to a US Grand Prix, which I think was 2004. Is that I think that's the one where the Michelin runners peeled off after the great.
I think that was 2005.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, in Indy 2005, I think it was.
Anyway,
I'd have to double check, but
I mean, that was the low point of my career, really. I always felt it was a real honour to put a team shirt on and to actually go to an F1 race. It was something really special, and I was always very proud to do that. And in America, it was the opposite. I felt absolutely awful to be wearing a team shirt, and it was the first time in my career that I'd had that feeling. The race was such a shambles. Obviously, for those of you that haven't seen it, basically there was a safety issue with the Michelin tire, and the decision as to whether to compete was left to the teams themselves, and the Michelin could not guarantee the safety of the tire. And so after the parade lap, all but I think there were six cars that started the race, and all the others peeled off after the parade lap and retired. And, you know, the crowd were seriously aggro, quite understandably. I mean, you think how much a ticket costs. And when it came to leaving the track, you know, our cars were mobbed by angry fans and bottles being thrown at the cars. I mean, it was really ugly. And at that time, I remember discussions in the team saying, well, the US is dead. Like, Formula One will never come back from this, because it had a tendency in those days to kind of rock up a little bit arrogantly as the biggest show in town. And, you know, we had really got a bad reputation for ourselves, and quite deservedly, actually. Mm-hmm. So fast forward 20 odd years. I mean, I think that's made an incredible turnaround. Has it cracked America? I think we've got to wait. I think if we can consistently keep this momentum for a few years, then yes, I think there's a good chance that we'll sit back and say, yes, we cracked it. I think that Netflix has helped massively. I think what the Netflix series did was make Formula One accessible, especially in America, in a way that was kind of understandable, and gave them a storyline, gave the sport stories without having to be a real fan and understand all the technical elements of Formula One. So it's done amazing things. So I think, yes, I think at the moment it's looking really, really good. I mean, three races in America, who would have thought that next year? Whether it's cracked it, we'll have to wait and see. But it's definitely on its way. I think as a purist, as a Formula One fan that's obviously loved the sport for ages, I felt a little bit like this race wasn't for the pure fans. I felt like this one was more for another audience. And that's fine. But I do think they've just got to be careful that they don't go too far over the line towards entertainment versus sport. You know, the one thing that we've absolutely got to do is keep F1 as the pinnacle of motorsport first, and then the entertainment after. And I think they're right on that line at the moment, and hopefully they won't cross over to it too much, because yes, it's great growing the sport and bringing new fans in, but you can't forget your base. From what I've read, you can see some people are a little bit miffed with all the hype. I think it was a really good thing, but I just hope that they don't kind of keep going too far, and it doesn't start to look like WWF. You know, that's what we don't want, for sure.
Well, it's certainly a long way away from a soggy day in Belgium, isn't it? It's completely different vibe. But I'm of the opinion with Formula One in the USA, especially when we look at the Miami Grand Prix we just had.
Yeah,
it's very much that is Miami's culture. That whole kind of fake, yeah, look at us, we're so great. That's Florida. That's what Florida is, and so that is their culture. In the same way that when we were going to South Korea, you know, we had Gangnam Style there dancing away, and the Indian Grand Prix as well. You immerse yourself in the culture of the place that you're going, and that's part of what a world championship should be. Do I want that to be every race? Absolutely not. If Silverstone started doing what Miami were doing, would I be up in arms? Of course I would be. I'd be, this is not Formula One. I'd be screaming. It's clouds and everything. I would hate it, but Miami, it works, because that's what Miami is. I imagine Las Vegas will be much the same. Texas is slightly different. It's going to be more kind of, hey, everything's so big here, and you know, big stakes and big hats and everything like that, and that's great. I love that about Texas, but I don't understand where all this hatred is coming from, and I think it's very much in a similar way to why the teams don't want Andretti in the sport. I think it's the a lot of the European-based fans don't want America to spoil their sport for them, because they've had it their way for such a long time. And you know, it's terribly un-British, isn't it? The Miami Grand Prix. It's just not cricket, is it? To be doing that kind of stuff.
Flaunting your wares. I know what you mean, but I think you're right, and I think they've got the balance just right at the moment, and I and and I hope it kind of stays there or thereabouts. And as you say, they've got to reflect the, they've got to appeal to the market that they're in, right? So I can imagine, I can imagine if you were there, it was probably awesome. Mm. And then if you, but if you're watching it on telly in Europe, you probably thought it was a bit cringy. But had you been there and part of the atmosphere, it probably would have felt absolutely right and fun. So yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. You got Vegas, you've got Monaco, you've got Miami. If you've got three glamour Grand Prix a year, we've got a 23 race calendar now. We can't have them all the same. We've got to have different vibes in different places. So I'm fine with it. As I said, I wouldn't want every race like it, but I think it's a good thing, and it makes the sport stronger as well. They could rename it the Netflix Grand Prix. I'll be happy with that, because it's for the Netflix fans, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, under Bernie, you know, Formula One was also saw tremendous growth. So I'm not knocking what he did. I mean, he's built the sport, but yeah, it was always very serious. This is about the sport, and no matter what market we went to, we'd put on exactly the same show. And like you say, the Americans were just like, what? Well, I don't get it. What's all the fuss about? And so I think, you know, a bit of bravado, a bit of showmanship, and a bit of colour, plus a documentary, and love it or hate the Netflix documentary. What it does do is it really sort of personalizes and bring stories out, which is what fans want to see, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, yeah, I think there's not really much more I can say on that. I have my rant.
I'm just jealous I wasn't there, and probably half the people that write these comments are jealous because they're not there, because it looked like so much good fun. We're stuck here, and we'll have to go to a rainy Silverstone later for our Formula One action, and it won't be anything like as glamorous. But anyway, it's all a bit of fun anyway.
Absolutely. So the Formula One season so far, then, how have you found it? The Formula One in 2022, the grand new Formula One, how's it been for you?
I think it's been really, really positive, actually. I think that we've seen a few really good a couple of really, really good races. I love the fact that Ferrari are back at the front. It's so important for Formula One to have Ferrari just in the race. They don't have to win everything, but you know, just to have them back up there as part of, you know, in contention for victory, I think is really important. I'm British. I do wave a Hamilton flag. It's disappointing, obviously, that they're not doing better, and I hope that they can get up there as well. But it's nice to see a different battle, and the dynamic between Leclerc and Verstappen, I think has been really interesting. I like Leclerc. I'm a big fan of his. He's very honest. I like the fact that he lambasts himself when he sticks it in the wall, and he's just very open. So big fan of that. I think that the new cars seem to be doing a decent job. At some point, we'll have to see. I've never been a fan of DRS, although I accept that it's needed, but it would be nice. It's so difficult, isn't it? Because sometimes it does what it's supposed to do, which is to put a car in a position where it can make an overtake, and sometimes it's just ridiculous. It just kind of, the car just it just blasts by, which is a real shame. So I think that there's a lot of things still to tweak, but I think it's going in the right direction. I think it's a good start, and let's hope that they can continue to kind of tweak it so that it ends in a good place. For me, I think it looks like it's going the right way. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I'm enjoying the added element of racing that we've got now, that people can seem to be, you know, they can be passed and then they can come back and then repass again. We've not really seen that since the 80s, really, where, you know, it's always been, you know, a car will catch and pass, or will catch and stay there. There's never been this whole kind of these multi-lap battles where, you know, it's not just a case of will he or won't he pass him, it's can he get him back again, and that we haven't seen for a long time. So that's great, and the fact that they do seem to be able to follow better. But like you, I'm very I've always understood the need for DRS, but I knew that this year they couldn't just get rid of it, because you don't want to throw the baby out the bathwater. You fix one problem and create another. it's definitely, like you say, in the right direction. But I do feel that DRS has been more of a negative this year than any other year so far. I think it was just farcical in the first few races, where it was all about, no, I don't want to overtake because I want to make sure I get the DRS, and yeah. that's not racing. I it's another strategic element, yes, but it should be about trying to get your car in front, not about trying to make sure you're behind at the exact point to make sure that you get ahead later on. It just doesn't seem like racing to me. So that again needs tweaking, but it's the first year of a new era. So we have to be very, we're not going to get it perfect first time. So absolutely needs a little bit more tweaking and a little bit more honing.
And then on top of that, just to chip back in, I think the other really interesting storylines have been kind of second career chances for drivers that might have been written off quite a lot. So, we're seeing Bottas drive really well. We're seeing Albon doing a great job as well. And that's been really interesting to see how drivers get on in different environments. I think that's been another good storyline for the season. So I think so far so good. And I hope Mercedes get into the fight, and I hope that I hope Ferrari and Red Bull are like this all year. But it does feel a little bit like Red Bull are going to start inching ahead, unless Ferrari can get some more straight line speed. But the car philosophies are so different that could be tricky.
Yeah, I think it will. It will. Ebb and flow between tracks. I think Ferrari will have times when they will be the fastest car again, but Red Bull do seem like they just seem to be on this run at the moment. But I just don't understand how that, with everything that they were doing in a budget cap last year, everything they're throwing at the car now, and it just seems like surely they're going to run out of money at some point, because they can't just keep developing the car. And if they are, then questions got. I'm not saying they're cheating, but I'm just saying, how are they doing this when other teams, Mercedes have brought hardly any updates to their car in the last couple of years. Since 2020, they cut off development on that car very early to focus on 2022, not even on 2021. Then when 2021 didn't start so well for them, they obviously switched focus back a little bit, which probably took their eye off the ball for this year. But even so, like the amount of upgrades that Mercedes have been bringing just pale into insignificance to what Red Bull have brought, and I just don't understand how they've done it. I mean, it's great they've pulled themselves back into this position where they hadn't been since 2013, and characters aside, the certain characters in Red Bull that I'm less than kind of favorable about my opinions of them, but it's good for the team. So it's good to see them fighting up there again. And with Ferrari as well, like you say, I'm very happy about that. But I'm still a little bit heartbroken that McLaren didn't, find a double diffuser style silver bullet and jump back to the front again. But there we go. So you mentioned about some of the drivers earlier. In your role, do you ever speak to do you ever deal with the drivers at all and that kind of thing? And if you do, who is it you like dealing with?
Oh, okay. Really good question. Not so much right now, but certainly over the years, when you're working in a commercial department, one of the things that your sponsors obviously want is access to the driver. That might be for an event. It might be for a commercial filming program for an advert or something. So over the years, had the opportunity to work with quite a few drivers, and to varying degrees of success, I would say, because some of them don't mind doing that sort of stuff, and others, especially if you're Finnish, and apparently really, really hate it and would make your life an absolute nightmare as you're kind of trying to get them to do one. Can we just do one more take of that sort of sip of drink or whatever it is? The drivers that one driver sort of stands out in terms of just professionalism and absolute doing everything to get the job done and making sure the sponsor was happy was Pedro de la Rosa. Incredible guy to work with from a marketing perspective. Really, really good. Alan McNish was fantastic as well. Back in the Toyota days. And then and Lewis, I had the chance to work with at McLaren in his first year. At that time, I don't know what he's like to work with now. But he was just brilliant. I mean, he just did everything that was asked of him. Very, very professional. Really good. And then, as you can imagine, there are some that are perhaps not quite so amenable. Fernando Alonso was quite tricky. I once had a motorhome full of private banking clients that were looking forward to sort of hearing from him. And he sort of hadn't had a great day in the car. And I sort of looked up and saw him bunking out the back of the motorhome and doing a runner, which wasn't great. So, you know, you kind of have all these ups and downs. There are some good characters. But yeah, It tends to be perhaps it's the guys that are, I don't know, I don't want to say it, but you know, to be world champion, you've got to be absolutely ruthless, and these guys are so focused on what's going on track that they just, everything else is quite frankly a distraction. And then you had the guys that were a little bit more amenable but maybe not quite so successful on track, and they were very happy to help and stuff. So it's interesting, but generally speaking, they're quite a tricky bunch to work with. You know, they're demanding. They're actually at the racetrack. They're entirely self-focused. That's all they're interested in. So, it can have its challenges and its good moments as well.
Yeah, well, I think Daniel Ricciardo alluded to that in a couple of years ago when he was at Renault, and his first race for Renault in Australia, and it ended obviously on the first straight. And he said after that race that he found he was just mentally drained and couldn't focus on his racing, and because he'd always said yes to absolutely everything when it came to his home Grand Prix, and he would spend 2 weeks just doing marketing and appearances and that kind of thing, and so he had to say then, I'm going to have to be selfish, I'm going to have to say no, which is going to make him very unpopular with a lot of people, but I think that was a really nice insight into what the drivers are put through. And I think now there's been talk this year of how they've removed some of the stuff for the teams on the Thursday, but they've made it a complete media day, or maybe even Wednesday, so that they're having to be there super early and just have, you know, a day of full interviews when they want to be focusing on like team strategy and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's actually getting worse for the drivers, not better, which is quite telling, really, when you see that. It's something we don't really think about. We just, you know, we hear these interviews and we see them, and we just think, oh yeah, you know, poor you have to sit in front of a camera and speak to millions of people for a couple of minutes, you know. But it's not that. It's, you know, it's across every country, and you know, every broadcaster wants their own soundbite, and it must be quite difficult to be able to get that, you know, get that, those 5 minutes here and there, and it must be very, very difficult and challenging for them.
I think it is. It's relentless, and I think you're right. It is getting worse as the kind of, you know, commercially, the demands on teams, you know, is always very high, and you have to give something back to the sponsors. You've got to deliver something back, and so teams are very, very controlling over how much driver time they promise in a contract. And especially when some drivers are very careful about how much time they promise in their contract with the team. So, you know, I remember when Fernando came back to Renault after his first stint at Renault, that we would always take the drivers from the paddock up to the paddock club to see the corporate sponsors, to do a bit of a Q&A, and then back down again to the motorhome. And it was actually in his contract that from the moment he left the motorhome to the moment he came back to the motorhome, it was 20 minutes, no more. So we had only 20 minutes to get him upstairs, do the interview, and back down again through all the people. I mean, But there's only a finite amount of time in a race weekend, and it's very pressured. It's tough. You do wonder how they concentrate on what they do. And I guess coming from Formula 2, that's probably one of the biggest differences for a driver, is suddenly they go from very little commercial obligation to just completely bonkers. So it's quite must be a massive adjustment to have to make.
Yeah, I think Yuki Tsunoda said that last year as well, that the difference that he had from going from his, you know, very kind of humble Formula 2 career, where he wasn't really noticed by a lot of people and very much protected by the Red Bull umbrella, and then all of a sudden thrust into the limelight, and the Yuki Tsunoda hype train was in full flow because he got points in his first race, and then it all just went down and, you know, downhill. Yeah. And then everyone's asking him, what's happened? Are you going to lose your drive? And it must be hard for them to come into that. But, I do want to touch on something that we kind of spoke about in the pre-chat. You mentioned about a certain character that you had an interesting story about, a certain maybe a promoter of a certain Grand Prix that's no longer on the calendar. So I'd like to hear about that, because that sounds really interesting.
Yes, yeah, so I was working for Renault at the time, and I think one really positive thing about the budget cap, just from Formula One's perspective, whereas before it used to be an arms race with open checkbook racing, basically, I think, you know, to have a budget for as a top team of 500 million euros a year was kind of roughly what you needed to win and to be competitive, was sort of 300 million euros. I mean, you can imagine the pressure that placed on teams to raise money and commercial sponsorship. And that's why for a long time we had tobacco companies and all those kind of things. And sometimes you will have seen deals that you're like, really? You know, is that a good thing that Formula One team's taking money from that company? And and I guess this was one of those. So I was working for Renault when we had Vitaly Petrov as a driver. And Renault at the time has just come under Genii ownership. And, you know, it was something like £2 million a week to keep the doors open of that factory. I mean, it was crazy, crazy budget. And so, I mean, I'm not saying we were desperate for money, but, you know, Vitaly Petrov got that seat. He was a very good driver, not taking anything away from him from that, but he obviously brought money with him. And he was very well connected with the establishment in Russia at the time. And I remember coming into the office one day and there was a tremendous commotion, people running around. It was, you know, and it wasn't a race week, so it was a bit odd. And finally, you can normally sort of find someone that will tell you what's going on, because it was all very secretive. But basically, they were running around trying to work out all the customs arrangements to get a Formula One car over to Russia, so that Vladimir Putin could have a go in a Formula One car. Right. Okay. So with the car flies over, and I believe it took place in a car park. And if you Google the pictures, you can actually see the pictures of Putin driving an F1 car. It was more or less in a car park, and the team owner was out there, Petrov was out there, and then at the end of the sort of play that he had, the story goes that Putin wrote three companies down on a piece of paper and handed them to the team boss and said, those companies will sponsor you next year. So everyone comes back, and then I get called into the boss's office Monday morning. Right, here are three companies. You need to call them and basically get the money off them. So these were the three easiest sponsorship deals that I ever did in my whole life, because these people had been told in no uncertain terms, you know, you're going to sponsor these teams. And so I gave each of these companies a call, and I had a kind of on the end of the phone was an equally bemused person on the end of each phone, because they've obviously been given this signal from on high and told to just get on with it. They didn't really know what Formula One was. They didn't know what they were buying, but they knew that they had to transfer this much money, and that we were going to give them something, whatever that was. Very, really bizarre. And so for that season, you know, if you look on the car where Petrov was driving, you've got, I think it was, Sibber, Lada was on the car as well. And I think, you know, one of the companies sort of was involved in arms manufacturing. You know, it was all just, messy. It felt messy. And I think that's one great thing about the budget cap today, actually, is that hopefully you'll see less of that. That's my Vladimir Putin story.
Wow.
Yeah, crazy. I definitely felt like I was a very small cog in a much larger machine at that point. But the easiest sponsorship deals I've ever done in my life.
Yeah, absolutely right about the budget cap there. And as well, going to a big manufacturer like Audi or Renault and you know, saying, well, how much do you need? And then it's just like, well, 500 million might be enough, you know, but we might need more. But now saying, you know, 145 million, 135 million, that is what we will spend. That's all we can spend. It's all of a sudden, you can quantify it and you can justify it a bit more. You can go to the board and say, this is how much we will spend on Formula One. This is what we hope to achieve for that. And then, you know, you can, you know, it's a lot more down to success rather than who has the deepest pockets then. So if teams will still come and go because, you know, the teams, doesn't matter how many manufacturers you've got in Formula One, they're not going to stay if they're not winning. So that's why we've seen Honda, you know, come and go all the time, because if they're not winning, then why are they spending the money? So you'll still have that, but at least it's going to be performance based, not financially based. So you're absolutely right. And that's a really good point to make there.
And I think as well, that's another reason why, not the only reason, but you, if you look at, from the sponsorship perspective, that there's been a huge influx of tech sponsors into Formula One. Now that teams have a budget cap, that they no longer have the open checkbook ability to, let's recruit 20 more people to write our own artificial intelligence program for this and that. Partnerships now, sponsorships are becoming a really important part of a team's performance because they obviously can't be seen to be spending the money. Now, what you get from a sponsor is factored into the budget cap, but obviously it leaves the door open to kind of it leaves a bit more wiggle room, especially with development costs and things like that. So you're seeing a lot of tech brands piling into F1 at the moment, partly because it's great for them, but also it's great for the teams because they can work with these partners to deliver stuff that the budget cap potentially could make quite difficult. It is factored into the budget cap, but it just gives a little bit more wiggle room, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, we've gone well over time, but I make absolutely no apologies for it because it's been a fascinating conversation. I'd love to hear, like, what, just for the rest of the season in Formula One, who do you think is going to win the World Championship and who has impressed you the most this year?
So I think... my heart says Leclerc to win the championship. Mm-hmm. It really does. Like, I desperately want him to win it, but my head says Verstappen will do it. And I think Red Bull are coming up very, very, very strong. And their car is so quick in a straight line. I think it'd be very difficult to race. Leclerc, part of the reason I love him is because he's a driver that just puts it on the limit so much, but he is prone to the odd mistake, and it won't take one or two more of those before Verstappen knows it. So I think Verstappen's probably going to sneak it and win the championship. And then most impressive, that's a tricky one. I would probably say maybe one of the biggest surprises, actually. I'd say probably Albon, actually. Mm. Because I'll be totally honest. I thought he was done. I thought he really didn't do a great job at Red Bull. And I thought when Williams hired him, I was like, what are they doing? And to be fair to the guy, he's operating at a really good level, and he looks a lot more confident. He's regathered. He's rebuilt himself, and he looks so. So he's probably been the most impressive, actually. I think good luck to him. He's come back strong. Yeah, a little bit like Gasly did after his Red Bull demotion.
Absolutely. Yeah. I, equally been very impressed with Alex Albon as well. So yeah, I think I'm with you. I think it's probably going to be a Verstappen championship the way things are panning out. Mm. But I've still got some slight hope that Carlos Sainz can get on top of it and win. But it's incredibly unlikely. I'm very much from the era that Ferrari the enemy. So it's great for Formula One to see them back up there. But if it's going to be somebody winning, I'd like it to be Sainz. But if it's Leclerc, it's Leclerc. Like you say, at least he's an out and out racer. He's a clear talent. He's got everything. But I do think he's probably a little too mistake prone at the moment still.
Yeah. He reminds me a little bit. I mean, obviously he's driving a Ferrari, so there's always that. But he reminds me a little bit of Gilles Villeneuve, just in the sense that he's on it all the time, and you know that with that comes greatness and incredible performances, and then sometimes you're going to have the odd glitch, but it should be a brilliant season between them.
Yeah, and Verstappen has upped his game from last year as well. He's driving better than last year, I think, as well, because he's got a better car. He doesn't need to push so hard, but as a result of that, he's just found another level again from last year, which is scary for the rest of the grid, to be honest.
Very
scary. Very much, yeah. But as I said, yeah, Jeremy, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to
Likewise,
you. And that's all we got for today. So if you'd like to follow us, you can follow us at F1 Chronicle, and I am at Tom Horrocks F1 if you want to follow me. Jeremy, is there anything that you want to plug social wise or your company website? Anything you want to talk about before we go?
Oh, not really. Only that if you're, you know, if you're a major brand and you're looking at getting involved in top level motorsport, I'd be delighted to hear from you and help you make some good choices and do a good deal. That's about it. That's my plug.
So basically what we're saying this is, Elon Musk, if you could go to frontrow-marketing.co.uk and get in contact with Jeremy, that would be fantastic.
Awesome.
Thank you very much to our audience as well. We will be back on Saturday when we preview the Spanish Grand Prix at the Circuit de Catalunya, which I will also be hosting. We look forward to seeing you all then. Goodbye.